Good afternoon, everyone. We're going to get started in just a few minutes. My name is Molly Marin. I am the webinar coordinator with the Technical Assistance Center. I'm very excited today because Dr. Virginia Bisey will be live tweeting during the webinar. I put a note on the chat about that if you would like to follow along on Twitter. That's the first time we're doing that, so we're really very excited about that. So a couple of reminders today. The PowerPoint slides are available on our webpage. If you do want them during the presentation, you can go out and grab those. That's nysrti.org. Also, at the end of the presentation today, I will post a link to our evaluation. If you could please take a few minutes to complete it. It's very short, and we very much appreciate your feedback. Today is our second webinar in the pre-K strand, the role of assessment in R&R. We also have three more webinars in this strand, and information and registration information is available on our webpage. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce our presenters today. We have Virginia Bisey and Ellen Peisner-Feinberg. They are senior scientists at the Frank Porter Graham Child Development Institute at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. They co-direct a program of research on recognition and response, a model of tiered instruction linked to formative assessment that was developed and is being validated with funding from the Institute for Education Sciences at the U.S. Department of Education. Drs. Bisey and Peisner-Feinberg and their team have conducted several studies to evaluate the effects of R&R on children's language and literacy skills. In a more recent study, they also developed and evaluated an adaptation of this model for addressing the language and literacy skills of Latino dual language learners. With funding from the U.S. Department of Education, they are currently working on an application of the model to improve early mathematics instruction for all children and to create targeted interventions for some children who need additional instructional supports. In 2013, they co-edited the Handbook of Response to Intervention in Early Childhood, published by Paul H. Brooks Publishing, and arguably the most comprehensive source of information available on this topic. Today they will present the role of assessment in R&R. They have reserved time at the end of the webinar for questions from participants, so please post your questions in the chat box. We'll use that chat box for questions mostly at the end, but if you have questions during, you can always post them as you have them. So at this time, I'm very pleased to introduce our presenters and turn it over to them. Welcome.
Thank you, Molly. This is Ellen Peisner-Feinberg, and I want to welcome you to our second in a series of five webinars on recognition and response. Together with my colleague Virginia Bisey, I'll be presenting today on the role of assessment in recognition and response while Virginia is live tweeting during the webinar. So you can follow or post comments about the webinar. To share with you, we have four objectives during the webinar today. We're going to discuss the current use of child assessment in early childhood, discuss the definition of assessment and consider how to use it for different purposes, examine the role of formative assessment within recognition and response, and consider practical applications of the assessment component of R&R in early childhood classrooms. Let's start out by sharing some results from a recently released study of assessment practices by state pre-K programs conducted by the National Institute for Early Education Research. First of all, one of the important findings from the study is that most states actually require their pre-K programs to collect child assessments. 43 states require this. Most states used this child assessment information to improve practice, to track child and program outcomes, or to make adjustments to curricula. Fewer than 35% of the states actually use child assessment results to determine kindergarten readiness or to make changes to their pre-K programs. In less than half of the states, we found the programs chose their child assessment measures, including locally designed measures. There's a lot of variability in what states use the assessment information for. That most instruments that were used actually assessed multiple domains of learning, but no single measure was used predominantly across the states. The most common measure that was used was the Teaching Strategies Gold or the Creative Curriculum Developmental Continuum, used in 12 states. The next most common was the Work Sampling System. Then a number of states used other measures, including the Child Observation Record, or CORE, the Developing Skills Checklist, the Peabody Picture Vocabulary Test, or the Developmental Indicators for the Assessment of Learning, as well as state-developed measures. However, what we see is that there's a lot of variability across states in what they use, including some using standardized measures, but some also using locally designed measures, which may or may not be standardized and may or may not have adequate reliability or validity. Of the 9 states that used Teaching Strategies Gold, the most commonly developed measure, even across this, the purposes for which these results were used varied greatly across the states. All of them used it in some form for professional development. Many of them used it to track child or program level outcomes. Several used it to make adjustments to curricula, and a few even used it to make program funding decisions. In addition, other states also used it for things like evaluating teacher performance, measuring kindergarten readiness, identifying programs for sanctions, or even making changes to state policy. So, what does this tell us overall about the state of assessment practices in pre-K in this country? Well, there's good news and there's bad news. The good news: most states are gathering child assessment data. That's good news. On the other hand, there's no broad consensus on which measures should be used in early childhood programs. We saw that there's a lot of variability across states in what measures they're using, and even the most commonly used measure was used by fewer than a quarter of the states. Good news. Well, most states are using a systematic approach to assessment, and some states are even using standardized measures, meaning that there's not only a systematic approach, but that the measures themselves have been tested so that we know that they're reliable and valid. The bad news, on the other hand, that there is often a mismatch between the types of tools that are being used and the stated purposes of child assessment. For example, we find things like states using diagnostic screeners, curriculum-based assessments, or rating scales to do things like determine program effectiveness, track child outcomes, or make adjustments to curricula. We even see sometimes the potential misuse of child assessment results with things like taking corrective action against programs based on the results of child assessment data. That's an overall look at what's happening across the states. Let's take a fresh look at assessment. Let's start out with the definition. What is child assessment? What do we mean by this? Child assessment is a systematic process for gathering, documenting, and interpreting information about a child's knowledge, skills, or abilities based on a sample of behavior. Now, at first, this may seem like a simple definition, but it involves several critical features. First of all, it involves a standardized process and set of materials. In other words, the approach and the materials that are used should be consistent and should be the same from one child to the next or from one person doing the assessment to the next. It entails the collection and documentation of information. It focuses on what the child knows and is able to do, as opposed to just somebody's impression about that. It represents a sample of behavior at a given point in time. This is important because assessment is actually based on a sample of behavior. It's a representative sample of behavior, but it's an indication of the kinds of things that a child knows at a given point in time. And finally, it includes a method for managing, interpreting, and using the information to make decisions. Again, depending on the purpose of assessment, those decisions may vary, but that would be the purpose of gathering assessment information. It's important to keep in mind that assessment is different in these ways than from instruction. The purpose is different and the method is different. When choosing assessments, what are some things that you need to consider? Well, first you need to think about the purpose of using the assessment. For example, are you using it for something like diagnostic screening to inform instruction for program evaluation? There are a number of different purposes. You need to decide who is going to administer the assessments. Will it be a teacher? Will it be a specialist? Will it be somebody inside or outside the program? You need to decide what types of tools are going to be used for conducting the assessment. That, of course, needs to be informed by the purpose of the assessment. And finally, you need to determine what the process will be, both for using and for sharing the assessment results. Within recognition and response, there are specific answers to these questions. The purpose of assessment is for informing instructional decision making. In terms of who administers the assessment, it's classroom teachers. In terms of the types of tools that are used, they're brief screeners of language, literacy, or math skills that are selected by the program. And finally, the process for using and sharing the results involves a web-based system that's used for managing the assessment data, as well as collaborative problem-solving teams that are created to help interpret the results and to help support all aspects of implementation. Let's delve a little deeper into each of these. What broadly are the purposes of assessment? What are different possible purposes that we could look at? Well, assessment could be used to determine whether children need additional instructional supports. It could be used to monitor children's progress in learning and development. It could be used to determine if children are achieving curriculum goals. It could be used for diagnostic screening, or it could be used for program evaluation. These are a number of different types of purposes of assessment, and all of which are valid purposes of assessment in different contexts. Within recognition and response, there's a very specific purpose. We use a type of assessment called formative assessment, which is used in two different forms. It's used in one form called universal screening, which is to determine whether children need additional instructional supports, and it's used for progress monitoring to monitor children's progress in learning and development. What are the different possible sources of information for child assessment? There are two major types of sources of information. There are formal assessments, which involve direct assessments of children's knowledge and skills. These are often referred to as standardized or norm-referenced assessments. And there are informal assessments. These are often take the form of observation and anecdotal records, or things such as work sampling, or ratings or checklists conducted by parents or teachers. there are advantages to each of these types of assessments. Formal assessments have standardized procedures, which mean that they're more reliable and more valid sources. They also allow for the examination of a particular child's level or rate of growth in relation to his or her peers. They also have well-established psychometrics. Informal assessments, on the other hand, have the advantage of only requiring the involvement and effort of the adult, and they're more likely to capture emerging skills or skills that may require judgment-based ratings. Within recognition and response, we use formal assessments of language, literacy, and math skills using standardized screening tools. Further, the tools that are used within recognition and response need to have certain properties. They're used for instructional planning, not for diagnostic evaluation. They need to be designed so that they can be used repeatedly. Assessments are conducted 3 times a year on a fall, winter, and spring basis, so they must be sensitive enough to capture changes in children's skills over that time period. They involve direct assessments of children's skills in language, literacy, and math. They need to be quick and easy to administer. They should take no more than about 5 to 10 minutes per child. Teachers need to be able to administer these to all children in their classroom 3 times a year. They also need to predict later achievement. For example, they need to relate to later skills in reading or in math. And finally, they need to be able to present information both on children's level and rate of growth. What are some examples of formative assessment tools that can be used within the recognition and response model? One example is the CPALS Plus, or the Circle Phonological Awareness Language and Literacy System Plus. This is a measure that involves language and literacy skills, as well as math skills, that is actually administered on a computer tablet or a handheld device. Another example is the individual growth and development indicators. This also involves a web-based system for recording results. This measure also is in the area of language and literacy skills. These are two measures that have been around for a few years at this point and are appropriate to use within this type of model or an RTI type of approach. There also are some other measures that are under development or are have been out for not as long. The Scribbles is a measure also of language and literacy skills that is being developed specifically to for an RTI approach. The ECI, or Early Communication Indicators, is a measure that's been developed to use with infants and toddlers. And finally, the PELI is another new measure that's coming out that's also in the area of language and literacy that's designed to be used in this type of approach as well. Let's take a review of the R&R model. Those of you who attended our first presentation have seen the model, but just to remind everybody what this looks like. Our model is a 3-tiered model. To start at the first tier, we have the foundation. At tier 1, we talk about the foundation of assessment and instruction for all children. This consists of a research-based core curriculum and intentional teaching for the response side of the model. And for the recognition side, we have formative assessment, which consists of universal screening for all children. We add to that at tier 2, we add explicit small group interventions, which are actually small group lessons in a particular content area. It may be language and literacy, or it may be math. along with embedded learning activities and continued formative assessment for progress monitoring for some children who are determined to need these additional small group lessons at Tier 2. Along with these children continue to get Tier 1, the foundational instruction as well. And then we add, in addition to that model, at Tier 3, for a few children who are determined on the basis of formative assessment to still be not making adequate progress, we add individualized scaffolding strategies. These are things like modeling or prompting or peer supports. We add those in addition to the small group lessons at Tier 2, along with the foundational instruction at Tier 1. The model is supported by a collaborative problem-solving process, which helps teachers interpret the assessment results and supports other aspects of implementation. What questions are addressed then in terms of assessment within the R&R model? Well, at Tier 1, the primary question is, do most children meet screening criteria? Which children need the targeted interventions? We look at the assessment results that were conducted on all children and then interpret those results to try to determine which children might need the additional supports within Tier 2. Based on those results, then, for Tier 2, the question is how well are those Tier 2 interventions working for some children who need additional supports? So this is the progress monitoring aspect, where we follow the formative assessment results and determine whether adjustments are needed to the interventions. Are children performing well with the Tier 2 supports? Do they need additional supports of Tier 3? Do they need continued support of Tier 2? That's the question that's asked of the formative assessment results at Tier 2. At Tier 3, the question is, how well are the Tier 3 interventions working for a few children who need more individualized and intensive supports? Again, it's similar to the question asked at Tier 2. It's a continued progress monitoring to say for those few children who are receiving both Tier 2 interventions and Tier 3 interventions, how well is that working? Are further adjustments needed? How does formative assessment work within R&R? Well, first, teachers administer the assessments to all children three times a year on a fall, winter, and spring schedule. The first period of assessment is at the beginning of the year to determine which children may need Tier 2 interventions in the fall. The second period comes at the end of the first round of intervention, and the third assessment comes at the end of the second round of intervention in the spring. Teachers use a web-based assessment system to record, store, and download the results. We believe that this is an important component of the R&R approach, that it makes it feasible for teachers to be able to administer the assessments and to implement the intervention. And finally, teachers use the collaborative problem-solving approach to interpret the assessment results and to make instructional decisions. What does formative assessment look like in R&R? We're going to show you a video example now of what this looks like using the CPALS Plus language and literacy skills. This is actually an example of teachers administering the assessment, and you will see a real example now. Okay. So that was an example of what it looks like to actually administer a formative assessment in the R&R model. A couple of things to show you in terms of what that looked like are that you notice that the teacher was administering the information on, in this case it was a handheld device, we've actually moved now to computer tablets. You can see how quick and easy it was for the teacher to administer that assessment, and you'll notice that the children seemed to really enjoy the process, that it actually seemed almost like a game to them. But it actually was an assessment process. It wasn't an instructional activity. It wasn't actually a game. It actually was a very systematic, standardized assessment, and it would have looked exactly the same. The process would be the same. The questions would be the same. The whole process would look exactly the same, regardless of who was administering it and regardless of which child was engaging in the assessment process. Now I'd like to introduce you to Marissa. Marissa is the lead teacher in a public pre-kindergarten classroom with 18 children enrolled. Last year, Marissa's program adopted the recognition and response system. Prior to implementing R&R, the entire program staff attended a series of planning meetings and participated in intensive professional development that addressed the key components of R&R. The assessment or recognition component, which involved universal screening and progress monitoring, the instruction or response component, which involved a core curriculum, intentional teaching, and targeted interventions, and a process for collaborative problem solving and decision making. This year, as part of R&R, Marissa is planning to administer the language and literacy screening assessments to all children in accordance with the recommended fall, winter, and spring schedule. Marissa's questions are that now that I've gathered the fall screening assessments, how do I use this information to determine which children should participate in the Tier 2 small group lessons? Let's take a look at Marissa's data. Here's an example of assessment results from Marissa's classroom. These represent screening scores from the fall or the first screening period on language and literacy screening. There's information from letter knowledge, vocabulary, and phonological awareness scales. And what you can see that on this measure, this is actually the CPALS Plus, that because there is no overall score, that the scores have to be rank ordered, and then an overall rank order is assigned based on these scores for each child. Looking at the overall ranks for these children, and you can see just some of the data are presented here for the first several children in each classroom. The four lowest scoring children, those are the children ranked 18th, 17th, 16th, and 15th, were determined that they would benefit from Tier 2 interventions. If you look at the column labeled tiers, you can see that all children are participating in Tier 1, of course, and that these first four children are also going to be participating in the Tier 2 intervention during the first intervention period in the fall. When you look at their scores, you can see that they scored very low on letters, vocabulary, and phonological awareness compared to their peers. So Marissa now has gone through the fall. These children have participated in the continued Tier 1 instruction for all children, and these four children have participated in the Tier 2 intervention. Now she's got a new question. Now that I've completed the fall intervention and gathered the winter assessments, how do I use this information for instructional decision making? So let's take a look at her results from the winter assessments. as you can see, the pattern here looks somewhat different from the fall. You'll notice that one child, Jacob, made little to no progress from the fall to the spring, from the first universal screening period to the second. He's made almost no gain, and his rank has remained the same. Therefore, it was determined that he would benefit by adding some Tier 3 individualized scaffolding supports in addition to continuing with the Tier 2 interventions for this child. In addition, two children, Sophia and Adrian, are continuing to make progress with the Tier 2 interventions, but are still performing low. And so the decision was made that they would benefit by continuing to receive the Tier 2 interventions, in addition to, of course, continuing to participate in the Tier 1 instruction for all children in the classroom. You'll notice that another child, Olivia, has made substantial progress after one period of Tier 2 interventions, that she is now performing within the upper half of the classroom and no longer needs the Tier 2 interventions. So she, in the spring period, is no longer participating in the Tier 2 intervention. And finally, we'll notice that a fifth child, Caleb, has been determined that at this point in the spring, that he would benefit from participating in the Tier 2 interventions, that he has been falling behind in his scores and is now ranked 16th within the class. And the decision was made by the collaborative problem-solving team that he would actually benefit by participating in the Tier 2 interventions. And so he will now be a fourth child participating in the Tier 2 small group lessons in the spring intervention window. So that now sums up what we wanted to share. Let's review what we've talked about today. First of all, we discussed the current state of child assessment in the U.S. We shared a definition of child assessment and discussed possible uses for this information. We looked more closely at formative assessment within recognition and response as one type of child assessment. And we shared examples of what formative assessment looks like in practice. What are some key things that we'd like you to remember about the use of assessment within recognition and response? Well, first, that formative assessment within recognition and response is used for making instructional decisions. Programs need to determine the specific screening tools. This is not something that usually a classroom can implement on their own, but this is really something that needs to be a program-wide decision. Teachers screen all children on a fall, winter, and spring schedule. For universal screening and progress monitoring, and it coincides with the intervention schedule of the Tier 2 and Tier 3 interventions. Teachers use these results through a collaborative solving process to monitor children's progress and determine which children need interventions, as well as to make any adjustments to existing interventions. Finally, we'll share with you here some references to the various tools and information that we've shared with you. You can obtain this from the website when the presentation is posted. And finally, we are ready to address any questions that you all have presented. So I can see that there are a couple of questions that have come up. The first question is asking about the thoughts about ages and stages. And again, I'll say that in terms of the assessment properties with regard to something like the types of assessments that are needed for recognition and response, this particular measure would not meet the characteristics that are needed for that. It is really based more on a rating for recognition and response. What you really need to have is a direct assessment of children's skills at a given point in time. So it needs to be a direct formal standardized assessment of language and literacy skills or math skills. It needs to be in a particular content area that's closely linked to the areas that are focused on in terms of the instruction and intervention areas. So it really would not be a good match for this particular purpose. I would say the question, again, there's a similar question about the core, and again, it would be the same sort of answer that one, it's a different type of assessment. It's more of it would fall in the category of more observational, anecdotal. But again, I think these types of measures are useful for other kinds of purposes, but they do not fit within the framework of the type of formative assessment that is needed within recognition and response. I think there are some questions about the types of assessments that would be recommended within recognition and response, and I think that's where we did have a previous slide that gave some examples. There really, at this point, are only two measures out there that work within this particular framework that are widely available, and that would be the CPALS Plus and the IGDIS measure. We then shared some examples of a couple of other measures that are under development at this time. That includes measures like the PELI and the Scribbles. And then there is the early communications indicator, which is the one measure we're aware of that's available for infants and toddlers. I think that maybe addresses this other question about children 6 to 36 weeks. Generally, all of these measures are largely focused on language and literacy. I will say that the CPALS Plus does have a math scale to it as well, but the other measures all are focused just on the language and literacy component. So we really have a lot more available in that area than in other areas. There's a question about additional diagnostic assessment for children who may receive Tier 3 intervention. Let me just sort of take a moment and just talk about that a little bit here. That within the recognition and response model, Tier 3 is actually what we talk about in terms of additional individualized scaffolding supports for children who are receiving the Tier 2. So it's things like providing modeling, prompting, peer supports to try to help further their ability to benefit from the Tier 1 instruction and the Tier 2 interventions. Our model perhaps differs a little bit from some other models of RTI that are out there, where Tier 3 often is equated with special education. In our model, that really, we see diagnosis and referral as a separate set of events that should happen when they need to happen, but those happen independently from what is happening within recognition and response. I think we see a couple other people are typing, so we'll wait just a moment and see if some more questions are coming up. Yes, or feel free to tweet your questions as well. So here's a question. This is a complicated question, so I'm going to just read it out loud and then try to respond to this, which is, I understand the purpose of a child needing to be placed in Tier 1, Tier 2, and Tier 3. However, how do you find enough time in the day to make that work, require after school? That's a good question. I think that's often, you know, an important question that teachers often have when they first hear about such an approach. What we have found as we've been working with teachers is once they learn how this model works, I think often that that fear goes away, I'll say that. The way we do this is, first of all, to understand Tier 1 is what you're already doing in the classroom. That is the core instruction that's already happening in the classroom. Hopefully, you know, it's that there's already a core curriculum and intentional teaching in place within the classroom. If not, that would be a place for a program to start and make sure that that good foundation is already in place. The Tier 2, the way to think about that is that in terms of, we've got, you know, we're talking here, I guess, both about the assessment piece and the instruction and intervention piece. In terms of these assessments, like I had said, these are very, very brief assessments that the teachers do. It takes usually 5 to 10 minutes per child to do them. They can usually get through the whole class in anywhere from a couple of days to a week, depending on how much they choose to spread it out or do it all together. So it really doesn't take them very long to do the assessments on the children. They do it on a computerized assessment, so the information is actually administered. They use the computer tablet to gather the information, so it's all right there. They don't have to do anything in terms of transferring data or entering it, you know, anywhere else. So that makes the process very easy. There's a web-based system for them to then download the information and use it to be able to chart the results and look at the information and share that with the collaborative problem-solving team. In terms of the Tier 2 and Tier 3 interventions, the way that works is we talk about they're about 10 to 15 minute a day small group lessons over an 8 to 10 week period in both a fall and a spring window. Usually we suggest that teachers do that. We found that for many of them it usually works very well to do that, for example, during center time when, you know, for example, an assistant teacher might be supervising the rest of the children in centers or things like that. So it really is not something that takes a whole lot of time out of their day. We'll share more with you in the subsequent webinars about exactly how all of that works. And I'm going to let my colleague Virginia add to that.
Hi, this is Virginia Bicey. I've been busy tweeting, and so my fingers are really hot from all this tweeting, but I wanted to just add a little bit to what my colleague Ellen just said. When we go into early childhood classrooms, we see a lot of assessment going on. Teachers, and we have a lot of sympathy for teachers who are being asked to really do a lot of assessment. But when we ask teachers what they're doing with that assessment, with the results, oftentimes we don't get a very clear answer. And I don't think that's, you know, because teachers, you know, aren't being mindful about it. I think oftentimes they really aren't given a lot of direction or guidance about how to use that information. So I think, first of all, I just want to recognize that teachers are very busy. In their classrooms, they have a lot to do, and a lot of demands are being placed on them. So last thing we want to do in our model is place an additional demand in terms of one more assessment. So we're very mindful of that. And we would just say that the assessments that we introduce teachers to seem to be very helpful to them. And as Ellen said, it's often very surprising how helpful it is to be able to, at the beginning of the year and two time points beyond that throughout the year, look at how everybody's doing in some key areas, like language and literacy and math, for example, and some just very basic key concepts that you want every child to learn by the end of the year, and just have a sense of how everybody's doing, because oftentimes teachers know their children well, and they can intuit much of this, and they can base it on their more informal observations and so forth. So we're very cognizant of the fact that teachers are busy, and so we have purposely selected tools that we think are brief, easy to administer, as Ellen mentioned. And I just wanted to share with you just this notion that in early childhood, we think there we really need to do more work in terms of thinking about this whole area of assessment. You know, why are we gathering information? How are we using it? And maybe we need to start streamlining it a little bit and making sure that we're gathering information for a valid purpose and using it for the intended purpose and so forth. So we often start with just asking people to do a quick inventory. What are you gathering? How are you using it? And kind of create a bigger, you know, sort of assessment plan, a bigger picture. And then think about within that, how can you add a very quick screener that you can use to make some very important decisions about how to improve your instruction and to target it, the intensity of that instruction to children who need it most. Okay, I think we've got maybe another question that's come in. I'm going to hand the phone back to Ellen.
So I think there are, I see a question about the programs assessing the cost of web-based assessment. And, yeah, I mean, I think that's obviously a decision that a program would have to make in terms of what kinds of resources they have. And I'm not sure that's something we can really address for you. Again, our, you know, the programs we've worked with have, we've worked with some programs who've made the decision that that was something worthwhile. Certainly many programs do that with older children. It, I think, is not terribly expensive on a per-child basis, but obviously that would have to be a decision that individual programs would have to make.
Sorry, Virginia, again, I'm just going to add to what Ellen just said. I think the initial investment is in hardware. So, and obviously the programs we've worked with, we've had grant funds so that we were able to offset that cost for those participating schools and programs. We've moved from we've tried different devices. Right now we're looking at computer tablets, and those, obviously there's a cost to that. If you're going to invest in a iPad or some other type of computer tablet, they now have the mini tablets, as you know, and those are less expensive. I can tell you where the technology is going, and I think and soon we will have mobile applications that will that people will use on their phones. And I think that is going to be a great leveler, if you will, because I think when that happens, I think and many of these applications are free, as you know, or very inexpensive. So when that happens, I think you're going to see this innovation flip, and it's going to become much more widespread. I think right now that cost factor maybe prohibits some schools or many schools from participating, although in the K-12 world, they're finding ways of administering these formative assessments using technology. So it hasn't stopped them in K-12. I think in early childhood, we haven't had the same resources as they've had for older schools, or I mean for older school-age students. So I'm going to pass the phone back to Ellen.
So see a couple more questions. So I think sort of one just related to that is someone is talking about having struggled with hardware issues with administering the circle. And yes, I understand where you're coming from because we had a prior experience with a study where we had the same problem when they actually changed hardware. We are actually working with a vendor to develop an application for a computer tablet, and our understanding is that that's actually for our research, but our understanding is that the developer of the measure, Susan Landry, is working on the same thing to make that publicly available as well. I don't know exactly where they are in terms of their development with that, but I do think that is coming, and so hopefully that problem should be resolved soon. And I think, as Virginia said, I think everything's moving in a different direction. I think another question I see is, do the lessons done by, you know, therapists count as Tier 3 assessments? Let me sort of clarify that when we talk about formative assessment within R&R, what we're really talking about is using this particular type of screening assessment, and you really need to use that same measure for the fall, winter, and spring assessment. It is that same assessment that's used to determine both which children receive the Tier 2 and the Tier 3 assessments, and that's across all children. If you remember looking at the example of the assessment data that I showed you from the second universal screening period, those data are gathered on all children, regardless of whether they're participating in the Tier 2 intervention or not, and that's how we were able to figure out, for example, that one child who was not participating in Tier 2 actually was at a point where they would benefit from receiving that Tier 2 intervention in the spring, and another child who'd been receiving it no longer needed it, and yet a third child who was receiving the Tier 2 interventions actually would benefit from also receiving the Tier 3 individualized scaffolding. So it's the same assessment tool that's used at those three different points in time. The information's gathered on all children. It's used to determine what instruction and what intervention is most beneficial for each child at each point in time. So that information needs to be the same information across all children. So information gathered by therapists outside of that would not be a substitute for this information. That's not to say that it's always helpful. If you've got other information, you can always review that within your collaborative problem-solving team to help provide additional information. But you need to start with the basis of the same formative assessment information, and it really needs to be assessment. It needs to not be instruction, that those are two different animals. So we'll see if we've got another. Yeah, I think, you know, and just to sort of say, I think we've kind of indirectly addressed this issue a couple of times, but just to be clear, I think there was a question about whether we would recommend using other data sources and to inform or confirm eligibility for the different tiers. And I think this, you know, both ties in with the point Virginia was making earlier. I think, first of all, we'd say the first thing we'd recommend is to really consider what information you're gathering and why, and whether you really can make use of the various sources of information that you have. But I think the second point we'd say is that when you do have other useful sources of information, it's always helpful to have that other information within the collaborative problem-solving process, but that, again, the basis of the decision needs to be the formative assessment data, that you need to have a consistent and reliable source of information that's the same across all children. But once that's used for making the decisions, that this other information can also be used to help further inform these decisions. I Right. And, you know, again, I'll just reiterate that in terms of the instruction and intervention piece, the next two webinars are actually going to be focused on going more into in depth into exactly what those consist of. So we'll be providing more detail for you about that.
So there, I see a couple of questions about working in collaboration with other specialists like speech-language pathologists, and you know, how do you incorporate some of that assessment information? And I think where that is very helpful is when you get to a point where there might be the need to refer a child for further evaluation for possible special education eligibility determination. And we haven't talked about that in this presentation, and we don't generally talk about that within our model, but we see recognition and response really complementing, you know, the current sort of referral system that's already in place through IDEA, as opposed to how it works in school with school-age children, which is it can really sort of substitute for what was previously used to determine eligibility for a child to receive special education because of a specific learning disability. So we don't really talk about using R&R that way in pre-K. It's really meant to focus more on helping early childhood educators and their collaborators to really improve instruction for all children and to help them target their instructional interventions within the classroom context. But I think when you start talking about bringing in other assessment information that other specialists gather, then you know, you're really beginning to move into the realm of diagnostic evaluation. And I think that there is a time and place for that. But as I said, it really is thinking about how recognition and response can support the current special education system that's already in place. So I hope that addresses that question. And we have a little more time if there are more questions. Feel free to type them in. I didn't get any tweets from anybody. Somebody's typing, Ellen said, so we're going to wait for a minute and see if we get another question or comment. We're really at a disadvantage, as I said last week, because we can't see you, we can't hear you, we can't see your, you know, your body language, and so, you know, you could be, you know, all sitting there very frustrated right now, and we can't tell that, so it's very frustrating for us, but we would very much like to be there in person so that we can actually have a conversation. Okay, a question just popped in. Let me see if I can read that question. So do you see this model being able to help staff and or administration in a therapeutic preschool? And, you know, I'm not sure exactly what the therapeutic preschool model is that you're referring to, but I'm guessing it might be one that focuses on children's social-emotional behavior, challenging behaviors, and so forth. At least that's what I'm familiar with in terms of how it works here in North Carolina. And so I think if you're talking about children's behaviors or their social-emotional development and whether or not a tiered approach could work in that particular context, I mean, our answer would be yes. And, you know, there are models out there that specifically focus on how this would work in that particular context. But I'm not sure that's exactly what you mean here. It is. Okay. So, and I will say this, in terms of the assessment with respect to a tiered approach for social-emotional development, the field really needs more assessment tools. What we have right now in that particular area of social-emotional development relies on judgment. And so you have rating scales that rely on teachers' judgment or rating scales that rely on parents' or caregivers' judgments. And those are helpful, but they're somewhat biased. So it's very difficult. It's just difficult to think about how could you get an unbiased assessment of children's behavior when you've got the adults who are directly involved in that behavior are the ones actually rating it. And so there's a bit of bias built into that. So we don't have really good performance-based measures of that area. So that's a problem, I think, not just in early childhood, but, you know, in the K-12 world as well. It's just a challenge. We have much better tools, much more performance-based tools in the area of academic learning than we do social-emotional development. But in terms of the interventions, yes, we could think about a tiered approach and a way of organizing our interventions and behavioral supports in a tiered way as well. Okay. Okay. So it seems like we did answer that question from Marie. Thank you. I will just mention, while we're waiting to see if there are any more questions that will be typed in, that I think Ellen did mention this, but we have now worked with 3 or 4 different systems and different groups of teachers and different types of programs. We've been in Head Start, child care, and public school programs. So we've got quite a bit of experience, and I will say that in every one of those contexts, introducing formative assessments to teachers who haven't previously used them has been a very good experience, both for us and for them, and a very happy experience. And I think there's some skepticism in the beginning about how this is going to work and will teachers have enough time. But as I said, we're so cognizant of the demands on busy classroom teachers that we've carefully selected tools. We've made them technology-based so that it doesn't take a lot of time, and it provides, you know, a wealth of information to teachers that is like a gift. And then when you sit down in a group with them and all of the teachers have all of the results from each of their classrooms in front of them, it's just a wonderful resource to them to be able to look at that, the distribution of scores, to be able to get a sense of, you know, what children know and are able to do. And to make decisions on the basis of that is very empowering for teachers. And I think for many of them, it was the first time that they ever were introduced to an idea of how to use assessment in that context. And I think for us, it was always very rewarding to see how beneficial it was to teachers. So for those of you who are still skeptical about, oh, this is going to be hard and take a lot of my time and I'm not sure if it's worth it, I hope that you get an opportunity to explore this a little more deeply so you could see for yourself how this might work. And many of you out there probably are already doing this. It would be great if we could bring everybody together so we could share some of those experiences. Let's see. Do we have any other questions? Okay, it sounds like Molly is officially telling us that the session is coming to a close. So I'm going to thank everybody and give it back to Ellen, who's been the primary presenter today, to let her say goodbye as well.
So thank you all very much for attending this session on the role of assessment, and we look forward to hearing you, having you join us next time. And I just see one last question about the PowerPoint, and yes, as we had said at the beginning, these will be available and posted, the PowerPoint that was used for the presentation. Yes, and Molly has responded to that as well. So we hope to have you join us at our next presentation on Tier 1 instruction. So we look forward to seeing you. Thank you again. Bye.
Thank you both, Ellen and Virginia. If you could just hang on for 1 second for me, it's Molly.
Yes.
Okay.